Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
The March 11, 2011 earthquake and resulting tsunami in Japan caused massive loss of life and property destruction on the northern coast and islands. In that same hard-hit vicinity, on the coast, is located Fukushima 1 nuclear power plant, which was flooded by the tsunami and suffered a loss of backup power that led to a major emergency. A month later, on April 11th, the Fukushima accident was classified as a level 7 on the International Nuclear and Radiological Event Scale, the same level assigned to the Chernobyl accident in Russia in 1986.
Here today to discuss the Fukushima 1 accident and its implications for nuclear plant design is Elmer Lewis, who's Professor Emeritus of Mechanical Engineering at Northwestern University. Among his many accomplishments, Dr. Lewis has served as a guest scientist at the Nuclear Research Center in Germany. He's a fellow of the American Nuclear Society and has, during his career, been a frequent consultant to Argonne and Los Alamos National Laboratories. He's the author of the books Nuclear Power Reactor Safety and Fundamentals of Nuclear Reactor Physics. And that first book, Professor Lewis, seems particularly appropriate for this discussion today. Can you give us an overview of what happened at the Fukushima 1 power station?
Oh, very briefly, I can try. Basically, there was a 9 on the Richter scale earthquake followed very shortly thereafter by a tsunami, which flooded the plant. I think if it had only been the earthquake, the plant would have survived it reasonably well. However, the tsunami was well beyond what was the plant was designed to take. As a result, the reactor shut down. The chain reaction was stopped with the first indication of shaking of the earthquake, as it's supposed to be. So the reaction was shut down. However, in a nuclear plant, the radioactive byproducts of the chain reaction produce heat amounting to, at first, several percent of the full power of the plant and then decaying off slowly. This has to be cooled. If it's not, it can cause the reactor to melt. And in this case, because the tsunami destroyed the emergency core cooling systems, indeed, what happened is over a period of time, it appears that a good bit of the fuel in the plant did melt, and some of the radioactive products that were in the reactor escaped to the atmosphere. So that's a very brief account of what happened.
Do you have a sense of how long it took between the tsunami at which the fuel apparently melted?
It would be several hours before that would happen, because normally if the systems are working properly, you do have some time to get the emergency core cooling into effect. But because they were overwhelmed by the tsunami, and most particularly since the tsunami wiped out the generators that power the core cooling systems, even though they had a period of several hours, that wasn't nearly enough. I mean, we know now it's been months, and they still aren't, because of the melting, then they can't get into the plant for a long time thereafter.
When the material is overheated and escapes into the atmosphere, what exactly is it that's escaping into the atmosphere?
Fission products, because what happens is each time you have a nuclear fission, it splits the uranium atom into two pieces. And these are the so-called fission products, and they themselves are very radioactive. Now, there are, about 50 different fission products, because the nucleus can split in many ways. But there are a few that are more difficult to deal with than others. The primary one is the radioiodine, because there's a lot of it and it's very volatile, and so it's easy for it to get out of the plant into the atmosphere if the containment has been breached. The other one that's caused a great deal of problems is cesium, We could go into it a bit more if you look at historically at other accidents and so on. The iodine, as far as human health effects, can be dealt with pretty well if you impose quarantines on what people can eat and drink in the vicinity of the plant, and also you can take iodine pills, because the primary danger there is in thyroid cancer from having large intakes of radioiodine. And if you can prevent particularly children from drinking contaminated milk, where after Chernobyl, that was where apparently a lot of the thyroid cancer came from, that you can really reduce the risk of that greatly.
So it's not in that case, it's not something you're breathing in the air. If you can keep from ingesting it in food or water, you can reduce your risk.
Yeah. Now, if you breathe it in the air, some of it does get through and winds up collecting in the thyroid gland as well. But usually the larger source of it is in the milk, the food, the water supply, where there's a more direct route. And the other thing to point out is radioiodine has a half-life of just slightly over a week. So in the order of a few months, virtually all of it is decayed away. So it's not a long-term problem in that sense, where the cesium is more difficult to deal with because its half-life is roughly 30 years, as I remember.
So was there something unique in the design of the Fukushima reactor that made it more vulnerable in this case?
There's been a good bit of debate about that. It was a boiling water reactor, probably around a third of the power reactors in the world are boiling water reactors, maybe a quarter, be a closer number. And most of the others are pressurized water reactors. The containments of pressurized water reactors are bigger, and they don't rely on something called vapor suppression, which is a sophisticated system in boiling water reactors for if a lot of steam comes out of the reactor at high pressure, is quenching it in the so-called torus that's around the containment. So I would say that the containments of the boiling water reactors of that era are more complicated, and some would argue as a result more vulnerable to unanticipated combinations of events.
So the cooling apparently was an issue, or the loss of cooling. Is that particular design, the boiling water reactor, more sensitive to cooling requirements?
In most senses, no, because it tends to operate at a lower pressure than the pressurized water reactors. I'd say they're different. I wouldn't say more sensitive necessarily.
Is the situation stable now at the reactor? Is there a risk of a future contamination?
It seems that they are, if they don't have things totally under control, they're very close to it. They're in the recovery phase now of trying to figure out how to decontaminate what was contaminated early on and longer term to dispose of the remnants of the core that have been melted and if they aren't solidified already, should be, I would think, fairly soon, because the rate of heat coming off keeps getting less and less as time goes on.
And I think if I understood you correctly earlier, you said they still can't go in because of the way things are in there. Maybe it's because I've seen too many movies, but I always assume there's some kind of suit that a person can go on and go in any place and deal with it.
No. Well, the thing of it is there are three things you have to worry about with radiation. Well, make it four. One is inhaling the radiation. The second is ingesting it. A third one is just having it on your skin. And the fourth one is just having the radiation in the surrounding area. Now, the suits can prevent you from inhaling it or ingesting it or getting it on your skin, but if you're in a high radiation field, the radiation penetrates all that. because they're, like, for example, we were talking about the iodine. The primary cause there is thyroid cancer, and the suits would definitely prevent that. But the thing of it is, if the radiation field is high enough, it's going to penetrate. So even though it's not ingested, you'll get something called a whole body toast, which is basically the damage is distributed more or less evenly throughout your body then.
Does this accident have implications for U.S. reactors?
Yes and no. We only have at present, I think there are four reactors on the Pacific coast, which could be susceptible to tsunami. All four of those are pressurized water reactors rather than boiling water reactors. And I think they're less susceptible not only because of that, because in one case, I don't know about the second case, but in one, the reactor is located on top of a fairly high cliff that would have been out of range of this, even this tsunami. So for that particular, you know, sort of accident, the East Coast, I mean, there's the problem of flooding more generally. You can get flooding, as we well know, from hurricanes as well. But in those cases, it's not that you get hit by a sudden wall of water. It's a more gradual thing that gives you more time to react and take action beforehand.
As I understand it, the immediate cause of the problem in the reactor was the loss of cooling, or loss of power to supply cooling.
Right.
It would seem that if we're looking at vulnerability of U.S. reactors or reactors anywhere, the question this poses is there a risk of loss of cooling power, and is there a way to push that risk down to zero?
Well, it's hard to push any risk completely to zero, but there are certain measures that can be taken. The cooling systems are all redundant, and in fact, they have redundant diesel generators, but the difficulty in this case was that the tsunami knocked out the fuel supply for all of those generators, so that even though there may be redundant fuel tanks, you have what we call a common cause failure that knocked them all out. So, I mean, you design the best you can to prevent common cause failures. Typically, the generators are separated by concrete walls and other things such that if there's a fire in the reactor system, that it might destroy one diesel generator, but not them all. But in this case, the tsunami, and I'm very reluctant to criticize the Japanese because these plants were built 50 years ago, but they had the tanks for the fuel supply out on the beach. Now, I think when they designed the plants, they thought that they were protected by a seawall from the tsunamis, but the tsunami was higher than the seawall. And in fact, you could argue that even if you look at the historical record, there was another tsunami in Japan, I think in 1896, that was actually a bit higher than this one. So even looking at historical data, I can say this as Monday morning quarterbacking, but you know, they should have known that there could be tsunamis that were as great as this one on that particular site, and built that into the design of the cooling systems.
When you think of reactors in the U.S., are there any that you think of as being particularly at risk for any kind of reason?
No. I mean, obviously the reactors on the West Coast are designed to withstand more severe earthquakes than those on the East Coast, even though we had the earthquake in Virginia a couple of weeks ago. Some of them are closer to major population centers, like the Indian Point reactor outside of New York City, and that fact had to be built into the design when you were coming up with the criteria of what you had to design against to make sure that the proximity of large populations was taken into account and so on. But no, I can't point at a particular reactor and say I think that one's more dangerous than the others.
But are there lessons in what we've seen coming from Japan that would give us some better ideas about both design and operation of these kinds of facilities?
I think there are lessons that are particular to nuclear systems, but I think there are also some that are, you know, applicable to infrastructure more generally, whether it's, you know, bridges or buildings or dams or reactors. The one specific to nuclear reactors, I think one of the primary ones is we haven't spent nearly as much time worrying about spent fuel pits as we have about reactors proper, and that's changing, I think. You know, there's a lot of work that's going into making sure that those are more adequately protected. More generally, this whole thing of how you protect man-made structures from cataclysmic natural events, I mean, earthquakes and tsunamis being, of course, the two, the flooding of other causes, and that has been built in to some extent since the time that those particular reactors were built. There's a methodology called probabilistic risk assessment that's come into play that's basically put on the premise that the risk you face is equal to a probability or a frequency of a possible event times the consequences, usually in deaths or something similar to that. And so a lot of the design is based on looking at the product of those two things. Now, the difficulty is that when you get to very low probability events, you know, once in a century tsunamis, for example, the uncertainties in those probabilities get larger the smaller the probabilities are, because there's no statistical data or very little available to predict what they are. And I think that, you know, both the earthquake in Virginia, which was a, you know, once in a 100-year event, and these tsunamis that tell you that when you're designing, you have to have a design basis. You design against something, but I think more and more we're going to be looking at it and say, yeah, look, no matter how strong we've designed these things, it's always with some very low probability a chance that there'll be a natural disaster that'll overcome the design. And then what do you do to recover? And I think there, you know, knowing what we do now, we probably have equipment ready to put on planes or helicopters, such as drones, high-pressure hoses, the other things, where you can go in, and even if you've witnessed an event that's greater than what you've designed for, you have at least a procedure and a method that going back and doing the recovery the best as you can. Now, how you relate that to maybe a building collapsing from a severe earthquake, I think is a difficult question as well. But I think there's going to be much more emphasis on, okay, do you design things as safe as you possibly can, but then you assume that something worse than that happens? What mechanisms, infrastructure, and in the sense of recovery procedures, do you have in place to get in there and do something about it quickly?
So what, in a sense, what you're talking about is, at some level, looking away from the probabilities when the probabilities are really low, and focusing on the consequences and trying to answer the question, so what are we going to do when that happens, and being prepared for that.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of, I don't know if this is the right term, it's not really fail-safe, but it's a fail-soft approach, so that you can, even if the boat sinks, you're able to get out of the water.
And I think to some extent that the U.S. has done that because of the terrorist threat. There's been a lot of work with nuclear power plants on how you would recover if a terrorist actually did manage to take, even though that's considered a very low probability with the defense in depth against it. But if somebody could get in there and muck up the system, how would you get, for example, emergency power in if somebody were able to sabotage all the emergency generators? Could you, you know, bring them in by helicopter or something and replace them if that happened? Well, that same sort of scenario, it's whether a terrorist sabotages all the emergency equipment or whether a tsunami wipes it out. Do you have something as a backup that you could bring in and get it working again?
Does the Fukushima accident threaten the further development of nuclear power in this country and elsewhere?
Oh, that's a political, economic, sociological, technical question that's very difficult to answer. Certainly, it's not going to help. I mean, because of the increased public fear of accidents and so on that way. It looks as if the plants that are in the process of being licensed, at least a half a dozen or so of them, are going forward in I think one's in Alabama, Texas, and so on. I think the larger issue is an economic regulatory one, in that as long as we have no carbon tax, as long as we have no cap and trade, that it's cheaper to build coal plants without pollution control and get your power that way. Now, the difficulty is that the utility industry was restructured several years ago. So now there's a spot market for electricity in the same way there is for oil. So, for example, Exelon, which has the reactors around Chicago, sells its electricity, and it's in direct cost competition with other suppliers. And so if the other suppliers can build 30 coal plants, for example, Exelon is not going to be able to sell the electricity from a reactor if it costs more than that from coal plants. So I think that's the larger challenge than the safety issues right now. Natural gas is another somewhat cleaner competitor, a good deal cleaner competitor of nuclear energy. And, of course, the price of natural gas is very low now. So I think the hindrances to it are more in the economic realm than they are in the public sphere, although that certainly plays a significant role as well.
Interesting set of problems, and I particularly appreciate your bringing up the issue of risk assessment, because it affects, as you describe, lots of different elements of technology as they interact with natural processes and human systems, and it's something in the infrastructure field that we really have to pay attention to. We really appreciate your shedding some really useful light on a complicated situation. Thanks for being with us today, and we'll watch the news to see what develops in the nuclear industry.
And we hope it goes well and that there are no more accidents.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
You're certainly welcome.
Thank you.